Kristen Johnston was 28 years old when she was cast as John Lithgow's co-star in the hit NBC sitcom Third Rock from the Sun. Suddenly famous, Johnston was unprepared to handle the pressure. She ended up popping lots of pain pills, almost dying in a London hospital when an ulcer in her stomach exploded while she was set to start a new show on London's West End. Her new book, Guts, The Endless Follies and Tiny Triumphs of a Giant Disaster, is a very disturbing and very funny portrait of an addict who nearly succumbed to her disease, and it's a pleasure to welcome Karen Johnston to the roundtable.
Kristen.
I'm sorry. Hi, Kristen.
That's
how
all right.
Are you?
It's better than, usually people go Kirstie Alley with me, so I'll take Karen.
How are you?
I'm quite good. How are you?
I'm fine. You know, this book
is... Can I correct two things in your intro?
Well, sure. Go ahead.
Only because I'm a control freak drug addict. It's not a new book. It's out in paperback.
Well, new in paperback. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was actually just going to say that.
I was actually 26, not 28, when Third Rock happened.
So. All right.
There you go.
There's
and
the
my
record.
Name isn't Karen. So, other than that, you're batting 1,000.
I feel very good. You know, I read the book, and I was it is deeply personal, and it is something that it seems as though that you are you're reading almost letters or missives that you shouldn't be reading in some way,
because
it's that in a
bad way or
no, not so way. No, very much. I mean, as long as you're okay with it, it's fine. You know what I mean? It's, you know,
well,
that's good
be at this point.
So my thing was, at what point did you say, okay, it's all right to share this with a general audience?
Well, great question. First of all, thank you for reading it, because you have a shockingly very, you can't believe how many people don't and try to interview me. And they're like, so you're a gutsy girl, huh? You know. Anyway, when did I decide it was going to be okay? I guess I just went with it. You know, the thing about being in recovery, which I like to call better, I like to call it recovery as opposed to sobriety, because sober is so boring. It means you're like sober, you know, and don't have any fun anymore. But once in recovery, I think you start just sort of saying yes to stuff that, you know, you just sort of jump out of airplanes in a weird way, and you start getting braver, and this opportunity arose, and it sort of was an evolution of, you know, somebody, you know, read an email that I wrote, which ended up becoming the last chapter of the book, and encouraged me to do it. And so I just sort of went with it, despite some familial, naysayers. But I just sort of said, you know, if I'm going to talk about this, I want to write the book that I wish I could have read when I was sick and struggling. So I just went with that.
You mentioned that last chapter, which was an email that ultimately became a chapter in the book, but that was ultimately you were a couple of months sober and writing it to somebody who was newly sober.
Exactly. And then that sort of was hanging over my head the entire time, which was both a good and bad thing, you know, because I guess I knew the ending. Listen, let me tell you something. I reworked that email like crazy.
Sure.
But I actually found it, and it's very similar. It's just a lot shorter. But it's very similar to what ended up being in there. And, you know, it's just a sort of... some people didn't like it because all of a sudden there's a chapter where, you know, I've gone from talking to you, the audience, the reader, very intimately, telling you my story, and then all of a sudden I'm just sort of like talking to someone else in a weird way, or it feels like it sort of changes the person. I don't know how to explain it. You're smarter than me, and also it's 8:30 for me in the morning. So,
well, I certainly don't think I certainly don't think I'm smarter, but it does put.
Well, you're definitely more awake.
I'll go with that. But I do think that you put a cap on this experience because you get an understanding of. A fuller understanding of not only what you've gone through, but how this is so universal And also that there is a light at the end of the tunnel, that there is, yeah, it may be 5 months or 7 months or a year, but my God, that's still a hell of a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And absolutely. That's a great point. The thing that's been amazing to me is, Guts came out about a year ago today, a couple days ago.
Right.
So in the past year, I have obviously been contacted by hundreds of thousands of people. A lot, most addicts, but people, food addicts, people addicted to self-harm, people with, addicted to sex, whatever. Also people who love addicts or who loved an addict. And the thing that I found so incredible is it's so much more pervasive than we ever could. I think it's much more pervasive than even the stats, which are terrifying. The more and more I live and talk to people, the more I think my introduction chapter, where I sort of say, I think everybody's an addict, is true. I proved myself right, which is thrilling.
Meaning that, and this is the way I took it, and correct me if I'm wrong, or if you perceive
it. Oh, I will.
Well, I know you, yeah. I got that sense about you. I find it fascinating because if you were going to write about this this experience and you're going to tell us about this aspect of your life, what I find you talk about Guts, but this whole thing starts from a major health crisis, and if that's not a tap on the shoulder, I don't know what is.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It is a major epidemic, and it is drug addicts kill more people than gunshot victims. Drugs kill more people than car accidents. And yet I have found where there's no public outcry, there's no marching in the streets, there's no, like the gay movement that got AIDS, there's nothing. We just skulk around and we sit in church basements with styrofoam coffee cups. And I, crazily enough, I've become like an advocate for, because it's just making me insane that no one is saying, there's no health policy really for addiction. There's zero funding for addiction research. We don't care about drug addicts. We think drug addiction still is the pervasive feeling, is a question of willpower and a question of laziness. And the bottom line is, everything, all the medical, everything they're telling us, that's absolutely not true. And I can attest that if drug addiction had anything to do with willpower, trust me, you would not be talking to me about my, I would absolutely have stopped years ago. So it's not, it's real, it's an epidemic and no one's saying anything. I can't believe it.
Why do you think, and this is what I was going to, again, say that you could correct me on, but because you said everybody is an addict, and I,
I said everybody understands addiction. Yes, I did. But I go sort of say every post-pubescent person in America has understood addiction on some level at some point in their life.
Because the stresses that we have, and we can certainly argue about this, and they say, it was horrible 20 years ago, and or 50 years ago, or 100 years ago, or whatever the case may be. Yeah, I understand that. But right now, we have a lot of stresses in our lives, and it seems like many of us are just trying to get through the day, and we have different ways of dealing with it.
I think we're all self-treating depression in a huge way. A lot of people are very sad.
And that, because either one of two things happens. One, we self-medicate and we try to figure out how to make the pain stop. So it is from drinking or it is from drugs, or we go to see someone who prescribes something who then you take it and you feel better. So then you take more of it.
Well, that is,
or maybe or maybe
I'm
not,
huge,
obviously.
Because you're talking about two separate things. If you go to see like a psychiatrist who prescribes, you know, an antidepressant, that's a great thing. Those are not abusable. Personally, and not everybody in AA or whatever agrees with this, but I think it's great. To not be depressed. Okay.
But if you're just talking about
the doctor you go to with like a little bit of an ache in your shoulder who gives you Vicodin,
right,
and then all of a sudden you're screwed because then your mom dies and then you start taking it. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Everyone has we can all become addicts any second. Because what if your kids get run over and you have this bottle of Vicodin you take for your migraines and then all of a sudden it's because it kills more pain than, you know, it's not just physical, it kills emotional pain too. Wow, I got heated up. You woke me right on up.
See, that's good. Now,
what was your damn question? Sorry.
My question was, and it was more of a comment, but the question is that we have so many things that we have to deal with, and so many of us deal with it
it used to be worse thing.
Different ways.
Something about that.
Yeah.
The thing is, look, yes, we don't have to chop wood and then go get the thing from the water from the creek and then boil it. I get it. So it was harder. But there, in the way that there is a malaise, you know, like where everything's so easy and yet everything's so hard, and there is, we are addicted to, we want, you know, what am I looking for? I'm looking for a word when you are addicted to a high, you know, we become addicted to highs, and I don't know. I think it's a really hard world to be a happy person in.
Are we addicted to the highs, or are we addicted to the feeling of that moment where the pain, where that sadness is alleviated in some way, shape, or form for a moment?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I think, I can only speak for myself. I was addicted to both, for sure.
Yeah.
Because I was alleviating a depression, but I also am a stimulation junkie, so... Anything that, like, oh, God, I'm so bored. You know, I mean, boredom for me, it's like, not a good thing.
The way you talked about, you know, that idea of sober and then, yes, that's a diagnosis. You know, we're sober, we're clean.
Yeah.
And yet, you
we're
know,
boring.
What the, we're boring. You are far from boring, obviously.
Thank
so,
you.
so you.
This is me sober. Could you imagine me?
Well,
I would be a mess.
That was sort of where I was going with this question.
Right.
At what point did you realize, and was it a self-realization or was it a group effort in the sense of where you, I mean, you write about this in the book, but
yeah.
I want of what you're
you
willing
want your listeners
to share as to at what point you say to yourself, all right, you know, and besides the health crisis, you know, this is the train starting to go off the rails.
Yeah. Well, I said it to myself, and I think most addicts say it to them a number of times.
Yeah.
Many times. I mean, I quit on my own probably six times. I mean, you know, I went through withdrawals, everything by myself, you know. And the problem is the tsunami of sorrow, as I call it, that is only relevant to opiate addiction, because like cocaine addiction or alcohol addiction, within a week, you know, I'm a blonde actress, sue me if I'm a little off here, but it's pretty much out of your system, and then you're just navigating the emotional, you know, duress of what, which is massive, of being an addict. But the opiate addict has to also navigate the fact that their serotonin receptors are fried, and they don't really, you know, your happy receptors, and they don't really heal themselves for a good year and a half, you know, a year to a year and a half. So you're pretty much miserable for a year and a half, which is why opiate addiction is so difficult to stop. Because 2 months later and you're still going, you know, you have not laughed once, you know. And that's where medication, for me, was a lifesaver. I'm not saying it's for everyone, but there is medication out there that does very much help with that. But to answer your question, I knew that game was over when I got out of the hospital. You know, I'd been there two months. I'd lied the whole time, and I'd had a couple come to Jesus moments in the hospital, but wasn't ready to quit yet. But, and my best friend wrote me an email, and she said, my oldest best friend, and she said, we all know, we think you use drugs and Vicodin, and we think you're a mess, and blah, blah, blah. And I just, I'll never forget it, sitting on the edge of my bed. I was in London, and just feeling like someone had caught me. You know, the thing I'd been hiding for years was exposed. My big secret. And so that was pretty much it. I am proud of myself that, you know, I did deny it a little bit, but then like 2 days later, I ended up calling around to different rehabs and I just was like, this is too much. I can't do it anymore. But it's the whole evolution towards it. Really, there were four events that happened that if any one of them hadn't happened, I'm not sure what I would have done. But the biggest thing is when people talk to you, if somebody comes to you struggling with an addiction problem, if you can do anything but be angry at them, try to be loving and try to be forgiving if you can, unless they've really, you know, they've, you know, killed 10 prostitutes or whatever. But, you know, other than that, if you can just try to go, okay, you know, I'm going to try to go with you here on this. Man, my friends doing that just saved my life, you know.
And I assume, and it certainly seems by the end of the book, that you find yourself in that role now of being that person.
Oh, my God, I'm the world of the world.
Yeah. So, but I can't think of a greater pressure, Kristen. I mean, I can't think of...
I know. I agree. And that's why I definitely have written articles on the Fix and Addiction website saying, you know, I'm not Miss Sobriety, everyone. You know, if you want, you know, if you want, I don't know anything about addiction other than, you know, what I'm babbling about. You know, it's sort of my opinions. But I can't tell you what the best rehab for your uncle is. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, and also, if you want to get sober, go to AA or go to, you know what I mean? I don't know.
And
read my book and go to AA.
You know what worked for you, and you
exactly.
know, and you also know that it's a continual challenge. That and
it is, yes. But is that's this? I'm very, trust me, because I'm a fixer by nature, and that's part one of my it's just one of my triggers. So. I have worked very hard with a therapist and on self-care, on making sure I take care of myself first, you know. It's been a great opportunity to learn how to do that, for sure.
And to figure it all out. And I would assume writing about it helped you do that as well.
Oh, my God. It's changed my life in such a great, amazing way and made me so humble and so grateful and... I'm just honored. The whole experience has been just crazy and beautiful. And I mean, if you go on gutsthebook.com and you go to the Q&A section, the hundreds of people who are like, I'm 44 and I finished your book and I went to AA last night or whatever. Or, you know, I looked at myself and I finally realized why my boyfriend died, you know?
Oh,
I mean, just beautiful, beautiful stuff. And so that is... How could you ever fight that, you know?
It's gutsthebook.com. And,
oh, and also my show The X's on TV Land, which is super funny, starts its third season in June.
Third season in June, and it is very funny. It's a wonderful show. Kristen Johnson is the author of Guts, The Endless Follies and Tiny Triumphs of a Giant Disaster. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Kristen, you're great. Thank you
what
very much
pleasure.
For being with us.
What a pleasure. It's been talking to you, sir.
Thank you so much, and right back to you. I appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay, hon. Bye.
Thank you.